I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this week, President-elect Donald Trump tweeted, quote, "No one should be allowed to burn the American flag. If they do, there must be consequences, perhaps loss of citizenship or year in jail." Turns out the U.S. Supreme Court ruled almost 20 years ago that flag burning is protected speech under the First Amendment. Quoting the court, "Punishing desecration of the flag dilutes the very freedom that makes this emblem so revered." Our guest David Cole wrote legal briefs for this case. It involved a man who burned the flag at the 1984 Republican National Convention. He's professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University, incoming national legal director of the ACLU, a job he'll be starting in January, and wrote a book that came out earlier this year called Engines of Liberty. David Cole, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
Does this tweet worry you?
Well, I think it's deeply disturbing that the man who's going to become the most powerful government official in the United States shows so little understanding of or respect for basic constitutional principles. He got up the other morning and proposed not one but two unconstitutional acts, punishing people for burning the flag, which the Supreme Court has twice ruled is unconstitutional under the First Amendment, and stripping people of citizenship, which the Supreme Court has also twice ruled, cannot be done, no matter how egregious a citizen's actions are. Citizenship is a constitutional right, and the government can't take it away from you against your will, period, end of story. And yet here he is proposing that we do both.
Well, let's do Constitution 101 then. Why is flag burning free speech protected by the U.S. Constitution? What did the court say?
So the court said that look, the most basic principle of the First Amendment is that we don't want our government to be in the position of deciding what people can and cannot say, based on whether our government deems what they are saying to be offensive or troubling or controversial. That the very fact that flag burning is deemed offensive by many people is a reason to protect it, not a reason to give the government the power to suppress it. Because once you say that the government can single out particular acts of expression, and that's what flag burning is. It's a way of expressing one's views, and it's nothing more. It is a symbolic expression. Once you give the government the power to single out particular forms of expression, particular messages, and allow the government to put people in jail for engaging in those kinds of expressions, you no longer have free speech. Free speech requires that people be free to say things precisely that the government doesn't like and precisely that the majority finds troubling.
What's so interesting is once the court made that decision, it was clearly unpopular with members of Congress. They passed the Flag Protection Act. What did the court do about that?
Yeah, so that was interesting. I actually was counsel in both Texas versus Johnson, the Texas case, and then in United States versus Eichmann, which was the case the year following that similarly struck down the federal Flag Protection Act. And you know, essentially, what the court said was, we meant what we said a year ago. We're not changing our mind. What happened was the first decision came down, as controversial decisions often do from the court, at the end of its term, just before it goes on, you know, summer break.
Right.
That happens also to coincide with the 4th of July weekend most of the time, and it did this time. So, it's not the, if you're thinking about it from PR purposes, not the best idea to put out a decision saying it's okay to burn the flag right before the 4th of July holiday. And so members of Congress stayed in session, held off their break, stayed in session for a day and a half so that almost every member of Congress could get up on the floor of the Senate and the House and excoriate the court for this decision. And then the only question was, well, how do we respond? Do we, given that everybody thinks it's a terrible decision, do we amend the Constitution, or can we pass a new statute that avoids the problems presented by the Texas statute that the court struck down in Texas versus Johnson. And they took the latter route, you know, as the sort of more modest step.
Right.
They did, in fact, pass that statute. It did try to cure some of the problems with the Texas statute, but the basic problem couldn't be cured. And that is, it's just inconsistent with free speech for the government to say, we can prohibit a form of expression because we don't like it, because we find it offensive. And that's ultimately what all flag burning statutes are about. And so 1 year later, the Supreme Court took the case up yet again and said, we meant what we said. This is constitutionally protected expression. And then there was an effort to amend the Constitution, which came close. But failed.
Well, interesting. Looking at then Senator Hillary Clinton, she co-sponsored a proposal to outlaw flag burning. But she added, as I understand it, that if it was an incitement to violence, does that in any way change whether and how people can burn the American flag?
Well, look, if you are inciting violence, and your actions are likely and intended to produce that effect, there is a, you know, you can be prosecuted for inciting violence. You can also be prosecuted for threatening another person. So if you use a form of expression to threaten somebody else, that can be prohibited. But to single out a particular form of expression is problematic. Why not prohibit incitements to violence, period? You don't need to single out the flag. And when you do single out the flag, you're sending the message. There's something about flag burning that we particularly don't like. And what is it about flag burning that people don't like?
Right.
It's that it expresses disrespect for the United States.
Well, let me quote something that Antonin Scalia said a couple of years ago. In fact, he was in Philadelphia talking about this original Supreme Court decision. He said, if it were up to me, I would put in jail every sandal-wearing, scruffy-bearded weirdo who burns the American flag. But then he goes on to say, but I am not king. And he was part of the Supreme Court decision that was the majority on this decision.
That's right. We needed, in order to prevail in that case, we needed, as it turned out, both Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy, because it was a 5-4 decision. I don't think it was that surprising that Kennedy and Scalia joined us on the pro free speech side. Both of them have been, you know, fairly strong First Amendment supporters, particularly Justice Kennedy. And I think it is, you know, it is the right understanding of the Constitution. What's more surprising to me is that four justices dissented, and that it was, in fact, a close case. I don't think today it would be a close case. And the reason I say that is since Texas versus Johnson, in the 20 years since, every member of the Supreme Court has cited with approval the Texas versus Johnson case, because it stands for such a central bedrock principle of the First Amendment, which is that the government can't penalize expression because it or the majority of Americans find that particular expression to be offensive. That is a core principle of the First Amendment. You know, it's tested in those situations where we find the speech most offensive, but the court has withstood that test. So it did it with flag burning. It did it a couple of years ago in upholding the rights of the Westboro Baptist Church to hold up signs, you know, homophobic signs outside of a military funeral. It did it when people were arguing that you should be able to criminalize violent video games. It did it again. It has consistently said, look, the fact that many people find a particular form of expression offensive is not a reason to suppress it. It's a reason that the First Amendment protects it.
Let me pick up on the citizenship part. You mentioned that earlier, President-elect Donald Trump saying there must be consequences, either a year in jail or perhaps loss of citizenship. Are there any circumstances under which someone, an American citizen, could lose that citizenship because of something they did?
No. So it used to be yes. It used to be that there is a statute that said, look, if you go sign up for some other country's army, or if you go and take out an oath of citizenship in another country, and there were a variety of other things, you thereby forfeit your American citizenship. But that statute was challenged in the 1960s, and in a case called Efroyim versus Rusk in, I think, 1967, the Supreme Court said that statute is unconstitutional. And the reasons it's unconstitutional is that citizenship is a constitutional right. It's the right from which all other rights stem. And like other constitutional rights, it can't be taken away from you. You can give it up. You can voluntarily waive it, but it can't be taken away from you, no matter how egregiously you act. So, for example, you have a right to trial, you know, in a criminal proceeding.
Right.
No matter how horrifically you act, you have a right to trial. It can't be taken away from you. We're not going to say there's a certain number of people who we just are going to deny the right to trial to. People can give it up. They can voluntarily waive it, but it has to be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver. It cannot be taken away against their will. And the court said the same thing holds with respect to citizenship. Now, that has not stopped politicians from advocating that we strip Americans of their citizenship. Ted Cruz has advocated that in the last several years. Joe Lieberman advocated that. You know, it's easy politics because it sort of puts you on the side of patriotism and standing up for America, and it targets people who you think are doing things that are inconsistent with our values. But it's easy politics, but it's unconstitutional as a matter of law. And Donald Trump has shown, you know, a proclivity, I think, to, you know, go for easy politics, regardless of whether the actions he proposes are constitutional or not.
We're about a minute away from our first break here. And Donald Trump tweets. That's how he communicates a lot of his ideas. And I guess the question is, how seriously does anybody take a tweet? And if he puts people into positions of authority that essentially undo what he might suggest in a tweet, does that mollify you in any way, David Cole?
Well, I certainly hope that he doesn't try to put this proposal into practice. We will see when he takes office to what extent he actually follows through on the kinds of things he says. But I think, you know, there's also an issue of the responsibility you have as the leader of, you know, the leader elect of the country to be faithful to our Constitution and the values that it inscribes. And he's running roughshod over them already.
That's David Cole. He's currently professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University and incoming national legal director of the ACLU. And we called him up to get his reaction to Donald Trump tweeting about the consequences for burning the American flag. Also want to talk about some of the other constitutional issues that the president-elect has bumped up against. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm Marty Moscowen talking with David Cole about the U.S. Constitution. Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Dick: our liberties and free society can survive with or without the few flags, which will inevitably be burned with or without the amendment. A tweet from ATP: if flag burning is illegal, can I burn a cloth-drawn flag or a flag shirt? And then an email from Paul: Trump sees himself as a dictator, which he is in his world. Let me quote something, David, that the New York Times said about his calling for consequences for flag burning. They wrote, it's interesting that so many people who are eager to punish flag burners like Mr. Trump are at the same time so untroubled by speech that offends minorities, women, and other Americans. They rail against any concern about that kind of speech as political correctness. But in this country, flag burning is about as politically incorrect as anything you can do. That last sentence really jumped out at me. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's absolutely right. I mean, it is a form of what are people objecting to when they object to politically correct policies and attitudes? It is that the majority should somehow have the power to suppress voices that they find distasteful or offensive or demeaning or what have you. And at the end of the day, that is why there is support among the populace for statutes that prohibit burning the flag, because people find it offensive, demeaning, disrespectful, and the like. And so, yeah, if you believe in free expression in one setting, you ought to be consistent across the board. And Donald Trump is, I think, not shown that.
Let me ask you about something that Donald Trump said several times on the campaign trail, as did some of his surrogates, that they were going to, or he was going to, jail Hillary Clinton. Now, he has backtracked from that. But under any constitutional provision, would he have been allowed to do that?
Well,
this is Constitution 101, but go ahead.
Right. Not just because she's Hillary Clinton, and not just because she's was his opponent in the presidential election. Hillary Clinton is not above the law, and if in fact she had committed a crime and there was a prosecution and a fair trial and she was convicted, she could be jailed, just as Donald Trump could be jailed if he were found to have committed a crime and were given a fair trial. So but I think it was certainly unprecedented for a candidate in a presidential election in the United States to threaten his principal opponent with jail if he were to get elected, and it is wise that he has backed off of that threat.
What does the Constitution say about a president mixing business and politics?
The Constitution says that it is absolutely prohibited for a president to accept any gift or emolument.
The word that we're all learning now, emolument.
Right, an old-fashioned term that means payment, some sort of benefit from any foreign prince. There aren't too many more, many of them around, or state. And so the concern on that front is that Donald Trump has business interests all over the world, and as president, there is a real risk that foreign states and government corporations that are controlled by foreign states will seek to curry favor with Donald Trump by providing him with advantageous his businesses with advantageous agreements, and that then undermines the duty of single loyalty to the American people that the framers wanted the president to have. So that's a real challenge. Donald Trump yesterday said he's going to give up operational control of his businesses while president, but that doesn't do it. I mean, if he has ownership interests, and indeed if his family has ownership interests, and he knows what his businesses are and what his family's ownership interests are, and foreign countries know what those businesses are, there continues to be that risk that they're going to be providing him with emoluments, which are going to and that undermines, interferes with the duty of sole loyalty to the American people.
So is it up to Congress then to enforce the emoluments part of the Constitution?
Well, we haven't had an enforcement of the emoluments clause that I'm aware of, certainly not with a president. So it's a sort of case of first impression. But yes, one possibility is Congress could enforce it. It was understood at the time to be an impeachable offense. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is a lawsuit filed by a competitor. So say, a hotel here in Washington that's, down the street from the new Trump hotel here could sue if, in fact, there's evidence that foreign countries are, taking out rooms in that hotel in order to curry favor with the president.
Let me ask you one more thing, and then we're going to have to say goodbye to you. One of Donald Trump's surrogates actually said on Megyn Kelly's Fox News program that he was in support, and I think by association indicated that President-elect Donald Trump could be in support of a national registry of Muslims. What does the Constitution say about that?
Yeah, so Donald Trump himself called for that on the campaign trail. He also called for banning all Muslims from entering the country on the campaign trail. He also called for closing down mosques on the campaign trail. All of those proposals would be blatantly unconstitutional. The religion clauses of the Constitution in the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause, provide that the government can neither favor nor disfavor any particular religion. So singling out Muslims on the basis of their religious identity for registry, for a ban on entry, or for closing of their houses of worship would be a blatant violation of the religion clauses.
I actually have one more question before we have to say goodbye to you. One of the things, again, that Donald Trump had said on the campaign trail is that he would bring back waterboarding or methods that he described as a hell of a lot worse. Now, I'm thinking about our own laws, what President Obama did, CIA policy, international laws. Where does he stand on this?
Again, he stands outside the law. It is a violation of our Constitution to use waterboarding or torture. It is a violation of the laws of war. It is a violation of international human rights. And it is also a violation of Congress's statutes, because under John McCain's leadership during the Bush administration, Congress made it absolutely clear, again, over the Bush administration's strong objections, that that our government and no government official can use any form of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment against any person that we are holding anywhere in the world, regardless of their citizenship. So again, this is a completely unlawful proposal that he put forth. Another one that he has apparently backed off of. Since, you know, after he got elected, and I think it's good that he's backed off. It's deeply troubling that he was willing to, for demagogic purposes, propose something that was so blatantly unlawful.
Well, David Cole, I think you'll be very busy as the incoming National Legal Director of the ACLU. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Well, the Donald Trump administration is beginning to take shape. He has made a flurry of cabinet decisions in recent days. Tom Price to head up Health and Human Services, Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education, Steve Mnuchin for Treasury Secretary. Mnuchin actually is how you say his name. Jeff Sessions for Defense, Nikki Haley, UN Ambassador. What do these picks tell us about what's going to happen once Donald Trump is sworn in? And joining us are John Stanton. He's Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for BuzzFeed News. And John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be here.
And also with us is Ron Elving, a very familiar voice to NPR listeners, senior editor, correspondent on the Washington desk at NPR. And Ron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Ron, let me begin with you. Is this the kind of administration that Donald Trump promises voters on the campaign trail, as we have seen so far?
The one thing we may have learned thus far is that the Trump train of thought does not always run on a single track. In the first week, we got a lot of hardliners, real hardliners, people who were sometimes considered alt-right, and we've gone to calling that what it is, white nationalist, and they were certainly representative of what he had said on the campaign trail. I'm thinking here about senior advisor Steve right. Bannon, and of course, other people with regard to national security issues. Then in the second week, we suddenly got a break from white males. There were a lot of diverse people. All of a sudden, Nikki Haley, the South Carolina governor, who had been extraordinarily critical of Donald Trump during the campaign, was suddenly named to be the UN ambassador. And then we also got some other women who were added and some people who might be seen as a little bit more moderate. Then in the third week, we shifted into yet another gear, and we essentially got the bankers and billionaires crew that have been brought on board to essentially run the economic policy, or at least to be the heads of the major mechanisms of the economic policy for the new administration.
Well, John, and going to you, and based on what Ron Elving just told us, candidate Trump said he wanted to come to Washington to drain the swamp. And I don't mean this in a critical kind of way, but in many ways, are we talking about the swamp?
Well, it depends, I guess, on whose swamp you're talking about, right? I think, you know, he was clearly speaking about Democrats, right, and Democratic politics and policies. You know, he's not looking at New York financiers as part of the swamp. He's not looking even at Jeff Sessions as part of the swamp, despite the fact that Sessions has been in Washington for 20 years and has been trying to come to Washington for 40 years. You know, and so it is an interesting thing, I think, the most interesting to me, frankly, is that the people that support Donald Trump don't care that he is, in many cases, picking people who he railed against on the campaign trail, whether it's, you know, Goldman Sachs executives or you know, considering, or Nikki Haley, or even considering bringing on Mitt Romney. These kind of things, you would think, would be counter what everyone who, you know, really got worked up and cheered at his rallies wanted, and yet they seem to not care.
Well, I mean, we don't know yet, I guess, because they haven't been sworn in and we haven't had the start of the Trump administration. But, John, you're saying, at least at this point, you're not sensing that Trump supporters are a little concerned about who he is picking?
I mean, there are a few, like Joe Walsh, for instance, former congressman from Illinois, who's been pretty vocally critical of talking about Mitt Romney and some other folks. But by and large, if you talk to average voters, they don't care. They absolutely do not care. They think he's bringing in a whole new set of people. A lot of these people that he's bringing in have never had experience either in government or if they have, you know, like Jeff Sessions, they are very much sort of the consummate outsiders of the establishment as it's currently put together in Washington. And so I think that they see that as a good thing. And they, for whatever reason, have decided that they're going to trust him right now. And they are.
Right. Ron, do you think they don't care?
I'm not sure whether or not they are going to care sooner or later. I believe they will begin to notice some things if they see policies being made that they see as inimical to their own interests. So, for example, when Donald Trump has his victory tour rally in Cincinnati tonight, I doubt, although I don't know, I doubt that Steve Mnuchin, who is going to be the new Treasury Secretary, will be paraded on stage and introduced as the person who profited from the 2008 mortgage crisis or the person who had his own hedge fund after 17 years with Goldman Sachs. I don't know that that will be a feature of Donald Trump's rally tonight. I think that that would be probably unlikely. But Donald Trump is going to, at some point or another, have been president for a while. And the Treasury Department will have been under Steve Mnuchin for a while, and we will see what kind of policies they have and whether or not they make people in whatever we want to call the world of Donald Trump's voters, middle America, working-class America, white working-class America, whether or not they make life better for those people who felt that Donald Trump was a better bet on November 8th.
Well, it's interesting, Ron, the stock market seems very happy with President-elect Donald Trump.
That's something that has taken a lot of people by surprise because the night of the election, as you may recall,
yes,
markets all over the world sold off. People were really unhappy or disturbed at the idea of Donald Trump being the American version of Britain leaving the European Union or leaving the euro. And let's just back up for a moment and realize that that was a misread on the part of the markets because as soon as they started thinking about who Donald Trump really was, where he lives, where he made his money, how much money he has, the tax plan that he had put forward during the campaign showing just how much he would cut taxes for people like himself, people started thinking in the investment community, this can't be bad for us. And suddenly they started buying stocks again. And that was true across the board in the Western markets.
Well, let me play a clip from a position that has not been chosen, and this is for Secretary of State. John Kerry earlier this week had dinner with Donald Trump. But let me go back to March, and here's Mitt Romney. He's holding a press conference in March, and he's warning voters about a President Donald Trump. Let's give it a listen.
Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University. He's playing the members of the American public for suckers. He gets a free ride to the White House, and all we get is a lousy hat.
Ouch. Well, this is Mitt Romney speaking to the press on Tuesday as he is being considered for Secretary of State.
The last few weeks, he's been carrying out a transition effort, and I have to tell you, I've been impressed by what I've seen in the transition effort. The people he selected as members of his cabinet are solid, effective, capable people.
John, how do we reconcile those two comments about Donald Trump coming from Mitt Romney?
Well, I mean, this is very much This is Mitt Romney kissing the ring, and I think this it's kind of remarkable to watch somebody who had to do this in 2012, very much against his will, did not want to go to meet with Donald Trump, did not want to have to get, you know, hands laid upon him by Trump. He found him to be crass and kind of disgusting then, did it anyway. Trump made fun of him, told the whole world he came and did it, and then has used that against him very much ever since. And then for Romney to eventually sort of say, I've had it during the 2016 election and come out and be very vocal and in a lot of ways a very, very powerful opponent of Donald Trump, at least initially. And then for him to turn around and do this, just it's kind of remarkable. It's hard to understand how one does that, given the fact that it's pretty much unlike it. It's hard for me to believe that Donald Trump is really going to decide that he's his guy.
Ron, I saw someone say this is rather like The Apprentice, a show I didn't watch. But is this unprecedented, Ron?
Not for Donald Trump, because it is very much the way he did The Celebrity Apprentice and before that The Apprentice. The idea was to pose personalities off against each other and have them compete for the favor of the boss. And that is very much Donald Trump. So what we're seeing now with this competition for the Secretary of State's position is the longtime loyalist Rudy Giuliani, who has been as 180 degrees different from Mitt Romney with respect to the Donald Trump experience and trajectory as one could possibly be. And then you have a couple of generals, John Kelly, whom most people have not heard of, who is a former Marine general and a hardliner on border security. And then you've got David Petraeus, whom more or less everyone who's followed the news in the last 10, 15 years has heard of, former CIA director, as well as commander of the United States forces in Iraq, and somebody who has been controversial in some respects, but before that had been very highly respected as a kind of intellectual in the world of the Defense Department, but not necessarily a foreign diplomat. And now we're talking about him for Secretary of State. So four extraordinarily different people from each other, and perhaps there are others in the mix as well. We're told that they're down to four. We don't know that those are the four. We think that probably all but Kelly are in that group, and maybe Bob Corker is the actual other fourth. He's a Tennessee senator who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
And I got to jump in here. Got to jump
in
here, Ron.
For the job.
Yeah, hold on one sec. Ron Elving, John Stanton. We're talking about Trump's picks for his administration. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Ron Elving and John Stanton about the picks that Donald Trump has made over the last couple of weeks to serve in his administration. Ron Elving, of course, a very familiar voice to listeners here at WHYY, senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk at NPR, and John Stanton, Washington, D.C. bureau chief for BuzzFeed News. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a tweet from Margot. Says, wouldn't be so sure that former Trump supporters don't care. Word on the street is many are concerned, not ready to vocalize. No one wants to be told, I told you so. Let me ask you about Tom Price, and this is Donald Trump's choice to head up Health and Human Services. John, if I can go back to you, what do we need to know about Tom Price?
Well, Tom Price is one of the most, I would say, probably conservative members of the House of Representatives. He was a leading proponent of sort of the constant efforts to repeal Obamacare that we saw over the last 6 years that, you know, obviously never worked, but it was a way really to sort of keep this issue alive and to keep people focused on it, and obviously it was very effective in the end. He is very much anti-abortion. He will come down pretty hard on a lot of different issues, I think, in the end, that you know, particularly progressive and liberal people are going to find problematic, whether it's contraception or abortion or other issues like that, stem cell research, that kind of thing. They're going to find a lot of problems with him. I think conservatives are going to love him. He is, you know, sort of a down-home kind of a guy a little bit. He's from Georgia. He's very much in the sort of traditional mold of a conservative on these issues. And I think that they're going to find a guy that they really can identify with.
Going to you, Ron, I mean, he's also an orthopedic surgeon, and it seems like he's been more than just a critic of the Affordable Care Act. He actually has some ideas about how to replace it or how he would like to replace it.
We would call him a root and branch opponent of Obamacare. He has wanted total repeal, and he wants to replace it with a system that relies on the free market, the health insurance market, and also on things such as medical savings accounts, which would help people who at least had money to save, set money aside tax-free for medical costs, and would also rely on some regulation of the states so that people could more easily buy health insurance across state lines, some things of that nature. Critics of that approach have called that tinkering. Right. It does not really address the question of how do you make sure people have coverage if they haven't got the money to buy it themselves. It doesn't address the question of how you get coverage to people with pre-existing conditions. So Donald Trump has said he kind of likes the ideas in Obamacare that cover people with pre-existing conditions and also allow families to keep children on their own health insurance plan until they're 26 years old. And those things cost the private health insurance industry a great deal of money. They make it up with the mandate. They haven't been very happy with that balance as it is. If you take away the mandate, which makes people pay them for insurance, well, how are they going to pay for all those other things that Donald Trump likes? So it will be interesting to see how these two imaginations get together.
And I mean, there are also the, what is it, 20 million people, Ron, that signed up for the Affordable Care Act on the exchanges.
That's correct. And those people have an uncertain fate if Obamacare is simply repealed. Now, there is a school of thought that if you appoint Tom Price to be your Secretary of HHS, you have essentially bought peace with the entire repeal it crew, the entire crowd that wants to go all the way back to 2009. And once you've done that, then you can begin to deal. Then you can begin to do what Donald Trump likes to do, which is negotiate to get what he wants and find out what you can get from the private insurance industry and how much you can do for those 20 million. But in the meantime, if you do, in fact, repeal Obamacare on day one, as they have talked about doing, not saying they will, but if you do that, you're going to leave a lot of people in the lurch.
Let me put another name on the table. This is to you, John. This is Donald Trump's proposal for Education Secretary, a woman named, I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly, Betsy DeVos. She's a Republican fundraiser. She's a very ardent school choice advocate. She's from Michigan. What do we need to know about her?
I mean, again, I think she is, you kind of summed it up quite nicely, right? Yeah, I think she is very much a traditional Republican on the issue of school choice. You're not going to see, she's not going to be sort of the early Reagan type of education secretary that maybe wants to get rid of the Department of Education entirely. She will definitely use it as a way to forward sort of the school choice agenda that has been gaining momentum, actually not just amongst Republicans, but also with some Democrats, as sort of exemplified by Michelle Rhee here in Washington with charter schools and that kind of thing. So she's going to be, I think, a very sort of standard issue Republican on these issues. Again, she's very conservative. Folks that vote on this issue are going to be very happy with her. People that you know, I think the teachers unions are going to find an absolutely hostile person to have to deal with in those. But I think that, you know, this is again, he's very much following a traditional playbook with this pick.
School choice, voucher proponent, charter schools. Ron, in certain ways, Philadelphia has been experimenting with almost all of that over the last 10 years or so.
Yes, and there have been mixed results in many major American cities with both charter schools and with voucher programs. And there will be a new chapter written in the essentially hybridizing of our public school system. And perhaps this is going to favor existing private schools. Perhaps it's going to create a whole new class of schools that are neither truly private nor truly public. And Betsy DeVos also has a connection here, much like Mitt Romney does, to the more conventional kind of Republican, the kind of establishment Republican that really can't wriggle out from under being called that. Hmm. Her husband, Dick DeVos, is heir to the Amway fortune. That is one of the great fortunes in America. It certainly makes them among the richest people in Michigan. They've been a force in Michigan and Republican politics for many years. So again, Donald Trump is peopling his cabinet with different kinds of characters who each bring something to that cabinet table that helps him with different parts of the Republican Party per se and also the larger conservative universe.
John, I'm reading a headline from the Washington Post this morning. Donald Trump is assembling the richest administration in modern American history. We have, I think, two billionaires, as I count up, and of course Donald Trump says he's a billionaire as well. What should we make of that?
Well, you know, I'll be honest. I think that we shouldn't make too much of that. I mean, it's not that as if the Obama administration was bringing in a bunch of, you know, poor guys that were working in the trenches of the world, right?
Right.
Like, the Democrats in Washington are pretty much just as wealthy as Republicans are. And I think that, you know, I mean, obviously he's not bringing in sort of these from-the-bottom-up populist types that I think some people interpreted some of his language to mean he was going to try to bring in, which I don't know that he actually ever really was, you know, saying, frankly. I mean, I think a lot of people maybe thought, for instance, he'd bring Joe Arpaio to Washington, which obviously is never going to happen. But, you know, I mean, he is in a lot of ways a traditional Republican.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's John Stanton, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for BuzzFeed News, and Ron Elving, Senior Editor and Correspondent on the Washington desk at NPR. And we are talking about the various people that Donald Trump has selected to serve in his administration, getting some thumbnail portraits of each of them. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. An email from Anne Marie. I had little respect for Mitt Romney prior to the election, although I did agree with his assessment on Trump. Now I have no respect for him. I guess that's after we played that clip. Let's see what Anthony from the Bay Area in California has to say. Anthony, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty. Thanks for taking my call. And
sure.
Hello to your guest.
Sure.
So I just want to say, I mean, what we're seeing with Donald Trump is just the continuation of the oligarchy that is the United States now. You know, people were so saying, you know, he's going to drain the swamp, but it's surrounding himself with Betsy DeVos, whose family is worth $5.1 billion, which she never went to public school. Wilbur Ross for the Commerce Secretary, he used to work for the Rothschilds. You know, you look at Steve Mnuchin, who made $3.4 billion off the financial crisis from the One West Bank that he sold, which is a former name before that. But you look at what's going on, and your guest just said it's not a big deal about the billionaires. But when you look at a 2014 Princeton study that came out saying we are no longer a democratically elected republic, this is what we're seeing. We're seeing a continuation of the 1% helping themselves and not looking out for the little people. And I tweeted out to you a lovely line in the Declaration of Independence that states that if the government becomes too draconian and you know, and not looking out for the safety and happiness of people, we have the right to, you know, to change that. And people need to realize that it's not Donald Trump. It's the oligarchs that are running everything. And we need to wake up to that. And hopefully you guys can comment on that. Thank you.
Well, I will certainly give both of my guests a chance to comment on that. Is this the rise, not just the rise, Ron, but the oligarchs now run the place?
I think you could refer to the rise and rise of money in American politics. It's certainly not a new story. In the late 1800s, Washington, D.C. was pretty much for sale to a large degree. There was a lot of great journalism done around the year 1900, 1910, in that progressive era, that exposed a lot of the bought and paid for policy in Washington, D.C., and things changed somewhat over the course of the 20th century. But in more recent decades, we have gone back in the other direction and begun dismantling a lot of the protections and the ethics and the campaign finance reforms that had been passed in the latter part of the 20th century, and kind of begun to introduce the idea that maybe we don't really care about all those things quite so much, and that money can flow freely. It's equated by the Supreme Court to speech and therefore cannot be restrained.
John, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's about right. This is not something that's new. I think one thing, though, that I find, I've always found, frankly, kind of problematic with people sort of trying to put this on the oligarchs and saying, you know, we've had a power taken away. People need to remember that they vote for these people. You know, and as someone who's from Washington, D.C., I kind of have a unique view of this because we don't actually have representatives in Congress. And so we have, you know, we hear a lot about how much people hate Washington, and it's just, we bring to people who are locals from here because we're like, well, why do you hate our city so much? You're the ones that send all these terrible people that you hate to Washington, right? And there continues to be this, it's everybody else's problem except for mine. My guy is not that bad. And particularly amongst Democrats and liberals, they have not gotten to the point where we saw Republicans in 2010, where you started to see people getting primaried out of office, or these things are such a tough primary. He decided not to run for office altogether on the Republican side. And it's still, I think, very pervasive. And so it gives them cover, frankly. I mean, the caller is right. There are a lot of very wealthy people that are calling their shots in this country, and they have for decades. But to a large degree, voters give them that authority and that power by how they vote.
Ron, let me go back to you. Elaine Chao, Donald Trump's selection for transportation secretary. She was labor secretary under the second Bush. She's also married to Mitch McConnell. What should we make of this person? And obviously, she's been around Washington for a while now.
You certainly cannot complain about Donald Trump's experience level in this cabinet, as many people have done. Many people have said it's the least experienced cabinet in terms of government that we've seen in quite a long time. That's not true of Elaine Chao. She certainly is an experienced hand. She is also, as you say, married to the Senate Majority Leader, and that is not perhaps something we should forget, because right. The person that Donald Trump needs more than anyone else in the United States Congress is Mitch McConnell. Mitch McConnell is a marvelous ally and an absolutely deadly opponent, as any one of the last couple of presidents could tell you. Whether he's in the majority or the minority, he knows how to stop the Senate in its tracks, and he can, on occasion, actually get the Senate to go forward, which is an even rarer skill. So, yes, he needs Mitch McConnell a great deal. Elaine Chao is a perfectly competent person to run the Department of Transportation. Of course, she was previously a perfectly competent person to run the Department of Labor, if you get my drift.
Right.
And this is something that makes a lot of sense and is one more case of him peopling his cabinet with the people he needs.
Pillow talk, Ron Elving. Is that what we're talking about here?
I just think that it's a line of communication. And I'm not commenting at all on any of the personal relationships
right.
involved here. But you send a certain signal, not only to Mitch McConnell, but to the Washington power structure and the Republican power structure in general, by choosing Elaine Chao.
John, I saw recently that Sarah Palin's name was being floated for Veterans Affairs. Now, again, obviously not selected, and it's part of this beauty pageant, I guess, it's being run. What do you make of that? Or is that just a one of those weird trial balloons?
I think it's probably going to end up being one of those weird trial balloons. I don't know that Sarah Palin much wants to do anything at all. So she seems to sort of like start projects and then stop them. And I think becoming the head of Veterans Affairs would have to be a lot of work for her. So I think she's probably been floating her name quite a bit. She's definitely been pushing the idea that she should be involved in the administration much harder than anybody that I've talked to over there realistically thinks that she might be. That said, you know, Veterans Affairs is one of those places where there is a pretty well-entrenched bureaucracy that, while they're trying to thin out, would be doing most of the actual work of the agency. So it could be the kind of place where if you wanted to bring in Sarah Palin and give her a job where, you know, it wouldn't require her to actually know what is going on, at least at the front end, that is the kind of place you could put her. I mean, if you put her in Interior or some of the other places that have been floated for her, there's a lot of really hard decisions that have to be made on the front end in those agencies on permitting and on things like that would require a much greater depth of knowledge probably than she or I or anybody else who really doesn't do that stuff for a living would have. So, you know, but again, I don't see her actually ending up in the administration at all.
What do you think, Ron? We're almost out of time here.
Well, let's go back to Cleveland and the Republican National Convention. There were an awful lot of people invited to speak at that convention, and Sarah Palin would probably have liked to have been one of them. And Donald Trump said, well, you know, we don't want to ask her to come that far from Alaska to Ohio.
I get your drift. Ron Elving, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk at NPR. And John Stanton, thank you for joining us as well.
Good to be here.
Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for BuzzFeed News. And we began our conversation with David Cole from the law school at Georgetown University. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowing. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.